You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 28th, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
It's a trap!
And Evan Bernstein.
Happy Halloween, ladies!
No sense of humor.
Awesome.
Happy Halloween.
Awesome, Evan.
Happy Halloween,
that
guys.
That is great.
Happy Halloween, ladies.
Happy Halloween.
That's a great one, Ev. Good,
that
good
was
job.
Good.
Well,
good.
How often does our show actually come out on Halloween?
Not often, you're right.
So you got to take advantage of that one when you can.
Yeah, usually I do some type of monster scream on Halloween, and for some reason I had to do General Akbar, or was it Admiral Akbar?
Admiral.
All right, Bob, come on. It's Halloween. This is your month. Tell us what's up.
Well, I've been slaving away in my basement, trying to get my basement looking pretty cool. And I must admit, it looks pretty awesome. I went with the whole pirate theme again with some upgrades, and it looks really sweet.
What are you going as, guys? What are you doing?
Oh, taking the daughter trick-or-treating, of course.
Are you going to wear a costume, Ev?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I was planning on taking my daughters around the neighborhood and extorting candy from our neighbors by threatening property destruction.
Hey, that's a good idea.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's how Halloween arose, you know. Literally, the parents were bribing the kids not to do any mischief, because mischief back then was really big. And going back, geez, I don't know, 60, 70 years or so, kids were really destructive. It was like hooligans running around doing all sorts of damage. Mischief night was October 30th.
Oh, yeah.
And the parents just kind of banded together and said, all right, let's just give them candy and say, you know, don't do anything and I'll give you candy. And then just totally blossomed from that.
Wow, I didn't even know that. I'm surprised I never read that.
That's where trick-or-treat comes from?
That's where trick-or-treating comes from. But all the other stuff came from other things.
So, like, what would the guy do? Like, open his front door and say, listen here, kids, come here. I'll give you candy,
yeah,
see?
Well, let's get on to some non-Halloween-related news.
Oh.
It's actually quite a bit of it, a busy week. We're going to start by talking about some swine flu scams.
What's swine flu?
Yeah, well, it's the season. You know, it's the season for Halloween, and it's the season for the flu. And this year, swine flu, as everybody, you know, up in arms, panicking, wondering what to do and so forth with H1N1 strain out there. And there's no void of people trying to take advantage of the situation by trying to pull things like offering, you know, fake cures, fake remedies, fake prevention medicines, mostly pretty much on the internet. And there's been a company that's been kind of tracking these. Mark Monitor is the name of the company, and they are a company that specializes in protection against things such as brand jacking and, you know, abuses of products and so forth. They kind of do a whole range of protection services. And amongst the things they do is they are tracking how many bogus claims there are for swine flu cures that are happening at pharmacies on the internet. They say that of the 3,000 online pharmacies that are currently offering swine flu cures, only 4 have been certified by the National Association Boards of Pharmacy as being legitimate.
I'm shocked. There's fake medicines on the internet.
But a lot of them, thousands of them. on average, these sites are pulling in 42,000 visitors per site per day.
Is it? Per day.
Yeah, daily visitors. 42,000 visitors per site.
They estimate $11 billion annual revenue.
Yeah.
Now, if you think about it, that $11 billion is spent on total nonsense. Nobody benefits whatsoever. You know, at best, you know, some people might, you know, psychologically feel better, but there actually isn't a benefit. That's $11 billion. That money could be spent so many different ways.
That number is up from $4 billion from just 2007. $10.7 billion, almost $11 billion this year. And it's because of the swine flu itself, you know, and how much press and, you know, politically speaking, it's been discussed in pretty much all circles, political, health-wise, and everywhere. This is a ripe time for the scam artists to be out there picking off people and taking full advantage of the situation. 49% of these fake pharmacies are based in China, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, there's something that really makes me uncomfortable about thinking about the idea of taking a medication or whatever, some type of thing I'm going to eat, put in my body that's made in China.
Well, after all the, you know, the lead scandals and everything, I mean, there is actually serious quality control concerns at the moment. Although I think they killed the guy who's the head of the Chinese version of the FDA.
I thought they killed multiple people that were scared.
Right.
They said they're going to crack down, but the bottom line is I just don't think I'm quite ready yet to trust product from China. But this is just also the tip of the iceberg. I mean, there is so much misinformation about H1N1 or so-called swine flu and the vaccine, and there's just, it's a mountain of misinformation just washing over the internet. A few sites trying to properly inform the public about the risks and strategies that are likely to be helpful. We're trying to promote the vaccine, which should at least mitigate the pandemic, but I think they've really successfully penetrated the average person. I hear from neighbors and friends and whatever that are really concerned about the vaccine. Not the usually conspiracy nuts or anti-vaccine loons, but just your average everyday person thinks now there's something to be scared about the vaccine. But it's all BS. It's all just completely made up nonsense by the anti-vaccinationists. But unfortunately, they've been very successful in spreading it.
So, Steve, what do you think we could do as the skeptical community? I mean, is it just a matter of us talking to our friends, neighbors, and colleagues and try to help them understand better? Or I feel pretty helpless.
Yeah, I think information is our primary tool. I mean, just plugging away on podcasts and blogs and certainly in our social circles, trying to point people in the direction of the correct information to counter all the misinformation out there. It's a lot easier to spread fear than information, unfortunately. Let's go on to the next news item. This is a quick update. We discussed a few weeks ago, actually at our live show in New York, that Hulda Clark had passed away. Hulda Clark was a cancer quack, wrote the book The Cure for All Cancer and then followed it up with The Cure for All Disease. She was one of these grand unification theory of quackery people who have like one cause of everything. And of course, her fake treatment could treat her fake cause of everything. That's how she could claim to cure all disease. And in her case, her fake cause was the liver fluke, right? Yeah, the liver fluke causes all cancer. New information came to light that Hulda Clark, the cancer quack extraordinaire, died of cancer.
Cancer.
Oh, irony sets in.
Yeah. That's about as ironic as it can get.
Not that much of a coincidence. Cancer is the second biggest killer. She's going to die of something, heart attack, cancer, stroke. It's going to be one of those three, chances are. She lived to an old age, so not surprising. Her death certificate indicates that she had multiple myeloma, which is blood cancer. And the primary causes of death were anemia and hypercalcemia, both of which can be caused by multiple myeloma. Now, her acolytes are claiming that the reason she couldn't cure herself is that by the time the diagnosis was discovered, she was too weak to operate the machinery to cure herself.
Oh, that's not special.
Poor thing. Yeah. I guess she'd never trained anybody to use it, I guess.
No. She just got rich off of selling books about things like that.
Right.
And sadly, no one's going to follow up and learn a lesson from this.
Nah, you're right. We'll point it out in the skeptical community, but the bottom line is I don't think this is going to have any reverberating effects. Her followers are already rationalizing it away. I don't think the next time, a cancer quack comes around, it's not going to be like, wait a minute, but that Hulda Clark thought she could cure cancer and she died of cancer.
Yeah.
People who are pursuing these fake cancer treatments are there probably because they are following their emotions, not their reason in the first place. So I doubt this information is going to have any impact on the cancer quackery industry, unfortunately.
It's such a BS story, like you said, Steve. On her website, it said that she couldn't even operate her synchrometer to cure herself. I mean, really?
Yeah, okay. That's the best they could do.
Yes.
So have you guys seen the video that's going around the skeptical blogosphere about the homeopath who explains the physics of homeopathy?
Oh, my God.
There is physics in homeopathy?
It was a painful video. I stopped after the first minute. I had to gather myself and then plow through the other like 6 minutes. And it got to the point where I couldn't even look at her talking. I had to close my eyes and just listen. It was bad.
So she claims all the mass in the universe can be condensed to the size of a bowling ball?
Is that true, Bob?
I've never heard of that, but it seems okay because, I mean, it started with a big bang, right? A singularity big bang. But that's trivially unimportant. So what? It's her take on that concept that is what's all messed up. Therefore, mass is unimportant.
So did you watch the whole thing, Steve?
Oh my God, yes. I inflicted that upon myself. This is one of the most scientifically illiterate rants I've ever heard. Seriously, this woman
is—it's up there, yeah.
No, wait, Steve,
nuclear stupidity.
Steve, you've been doing this a long time. That's a big statement over all your decades of skepticism and everything.
No, believe me, if I tried to parody something like this,
you can't. It is a parody.
I couldn't create something as stupid as this if I tried.
Steve, let me give one quick example of what you said.
Well, I in my blog on Science Based Medicine today, actually, I wrote a summary of what she said. I'll just read that.
Okay,
that's good.
This is in a nutshell. This is her point. Einstein taught us that energy equals matter and light, but because matter can be condensed down to a very small space, if you remove all the empty space between the elementary particles, we can mostly ignore matter. Therefore, energy is light, and we all are made of energy, not matter, or at least so little matter you can ignore it. Stephen Hawking, who she frequently
invokes,
who she consistently misnamed Hawking's, then came up with string theory, which he didn't, which tells us that all matter, which we can ignore, by the way, is made of vibrating strings. Therefore, we are made of vibrating energy. All diseases are therefore caused by unhealthy vibrational states, and all disease can be treated by returning the body to a previous healthy vibrational state. This can be done with homeopathy, which extracts the vibrational energy out of stuff and places it in a small pill that it can be used at any time.
From nothing to nothing.
That's it.
I made it coherent. Yeah. I mean, that was me making what she said at least semi-coherent.
Yeah, you upped it a level. That's it in a nutshell. That's the whole video in a nutshell right there.
That's the gobbledygook, claptrap, and anything else James Randi could have come up with to describe that nonsense.
And so I'm going to explain to you exactly how homeopathy works, and then that's what she comes out with. We can ignore E equals MC squared, but we can cross out the M because matter isn't really important.
We can cross out the M space. Because I brought a Sharpie with me, and look, I can make
an X. Just because you could conceivably condense matter into a counterintuitively small volume, she thinks that you can almost just kind of cross it out of that equation, and therefore energy equals light. And she doesn't realize that the whole
point
is
that... we have photoreceptors in our eyes because...
Yes.
So
Steve, remember when she's talking about string theory? She equates string theory with human ears, like they were violin strings.
Yes.
That was like, what?
It's as if she gleaned some physics jargon from somewhere, didn't understand a single word that she heard, and then reconstituted it as this pseudo-babble nonsense.
And you could tell by her delivery. Her delivery alone tells you, you know, it was not polished, it was not smooth at all. You could tell she was just kind of on the barest edge of even being able to parrot it, let alone understand it.
Exactly. She was totally out of her depth. The other story to this is that this woman who did this video, Charlene Werner, is a behavioral optometrist, which is a type of quackery all unto itself.
Uh-oh.
It's like the chiropractic of eye medicine, right? Yeah. I mean, if you think about it.
Iridology is involved?
No, it's its own brand of nonsense. It really has actually been flying under the radar. It's not the kind of thing you hear about a lot in skeptical circles. I think because
Until
it's just
now.
Kind of small and shrinking, you know, but it is about, you know, 100 or 200 years old. It's like homeopathy in a lot of ways. It has its own sort of subculture of belief. A lot of weird stuff. They believe in things like syntonic phototherapy, which if you like do a literature search on that, you come up with exactly zero publications. It's all this, you know, light can cure everything. You could do exercises to correct all these imaginary problems with your vision that therefore then will cure whatever ails you, your headaches or your fatigue, or it'll improve your sports performance or whatever. It really is just another pseudo-profession subculture of nonsense, pretty much rejected by legitimate optometry and ophthalmology. And from what I hear is a small and shrinking minority. But you know, these things never go away entirely. They're just on the fringe. So she's a quack to begin with. The fact that she also, prescribes homeopathy is therefore no surprise. And her, brain-dead, scientifically illiterate, hand-waving justification for homeopathy is just about as good as the homeopaths get. That's the other thing. It's not like we're picking on somebody who is giving a bizarre interpretation of homeopathy. She was fumbling and clumsy, but if you strip it down, that's basically what homeopaths think. There's the essence or the vibrational energy in this stuff that they prepare homeopathically is what's curing people. You know, it's just as much magical thinking as any of the crap that she said.
And what's ironic about that is, like, you know, she's naming Einstein and Hawking and, you know, and talking about these people with almost a
Hawking's, yeah.
Did I say it wrong?
No, she did. She said Hawking's. It's Stephen Hawking, but she kept calling
it. I said Hawking. All right, so excuse me. So anyway, so she's talking about, and I hate to put it like in these terms, but she's talking about our scientists, right?
Yeah.
Like with some type of respect, like in a respectful manner. Not only did she not understand what they say,
she's just trying to throw out names that the rubes in the audience might have heard before. You guys all heard of Einstein, right? Yeah. Anything to do with what you're talking about.
You all
about.
Know what H2O is, right?
Yeah, water. Einstein. Yeah. Vibrations. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I think she attached Stephen Hawking to string theory because it's a name they might recognize, even though he has nothing to do with string theory.
I heard of that guy. He's the guy in the science wheelchair guy.
Wouldn't it be awesome if he called her up and he's like, stop talking about me.
Deborah, you ignorant slut. Don't worry, Stephen. I took care of it for you.
I would love to see you in a room with that woman.
I imagine she would be impervious to any actual science or logic.
Yes, absolutely.
And the whole point of this is just to embarrass the quackery, the nonsense that is homeopathy, to try to penetrate that to the public a little bit so they realize, yeah, this is really something very stupid that needs to be ridiculed, not taken seriously.
And that's one of the main goals, I think, with wacky crap like homeopathy, the stuff that at the far end of the spectrum, so far that the public's reaction should be just to laugh whenever they hear about it, like, mm-hmm. Oh my god, that's so ridiculous. That's their like knee-jerk reaction to it, as it should be, as it absolutely should be.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jay, you're going to tell us about Scientology's latest shenanigans.
Really? I am. But first,
welcome, foolish mortals, to the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
That was good. That was actually pretty good.
That was good. Thanks, Satan.
Yeah. It's a bad week for Scientology, guys. Mm-hmm. A couple of really, really good news items.
That means it's a good week for everybody else.
So what happened was there were two leading branches of the Church of Scientology in France, and they were sentenced to pay fines in excess of €600,000 after being found guilty of, and this is what the court term, was fraud in an organized gang.
Who?
And that was in Paris, yeah. So the judge did allow them to continue their activities as a church in France, even though they were found guilty. And they estimate that there's about 45,000 members in France in the church. So the quick one-two on this one is that there are four officials of the church. They received suspended prison sentences between 18 months and 2 years, and they were also fined. The judge said that the four had avoided jail because the church was showing an effort in changing their ways. But they do expect an appeal soon.
Really?
So the case is based on two former female members alleging that they were pressured into paying large sums of money, to the church after joining in the 90s. They also said that the members of the church were harassing them, coercing them to buy a bunch of different products that the church sells, like vitamins and things like that. And I just thought it was, it's always weird when I hear that the Church of Scientology is selling like health items, vitamins and things. They were also pressuring the women to sign up for quote-unquote purification courses that cost thousands of euros, and one even said that she was advised by a financial advisor from the church to take out a large loan to finance all of her activities within the church.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
That is complete and total manipulation. The French prosecutor requested that the church be dissolved in France and wanted to fine them 4 million euros, but the courts no longer have the power to dissolve organizations that are found guilty of fraud. But I guess they used to, but they can't do it anymore. And of course, the church denies all wrongdoing, and then they want to you know, reopen the case to clear their name and everything. Okay, so the other thing that happened, do you guys know who Paul Haggis is?
Oh, yeah.
Haggis? So for
the Haggis is in the fire for sure.
Ugh. For those of you who don't know, he's an Oscar-winning writer-director, and he did movies like Crash, Million Dollar Baby, the last two Bond flicks. I actually think, you know, I really like his films.
He directed these movies?
He directed most of them, I think, but he was a co-writer in, I think, the Bond flicks. So he left the Church of Scientology last week after 35 years.
Wow.
And the two beefs that he had with the church were that he was very upset that the Church of Scientology was backing Proposition 8 in California, which is a ban on gay marriage.
That's what did it. That's what finally got him.
That and this next thing. The next thing that happened was as he and his wife, Deborah Renard, were ordered to break all contact with his wife's parents because his wife's parents left the church. So the church drummed up some fake accusations. You know, they have a lot of their own lingo and you know, laws that people could break inside of the church and everything. But basically, these people left the church. The church got pissed off and then told Haggis and his wife, you can't associate with them anymore. And, you know, the funny spin to that was that the parents actually introduced the couple to the church. Mm-hmm. So Haggis never followed the church's order for them to do that. And the two of them together tipped him over the edge. And what he did actually do, which I recommend everyone read, was he wrote a letter to, I guess, one of the people in the church who was making a lot of promises to him about how the church is actually, you know, not a part of agreeing with the ban on gay marriage. And the guy made him a bunch of promises like, you know, I'm outraged by all this and I'll get to the bottom of it. And it turns out that the guy was, you know, wholesale lying to Haggis. And he got pissed off and he left the church.
That could have legs because, you know, Scientology lures in a lot of Hollywood types as their base, really. And that's, you know, gay bashing's not going to fly well in Hollywood culture. You know, that could really stick to them.
Yeah.
I really don't understand why they would have a problem with same-sex marriage.
I don't know.
I don't remember reading anything that...
Nothing about, you know, I guess, CNews 75 million years ago saying don't do that.
I guess Elrond didn't like gay people.
Who knows? There's one other tiny bit of Scientology news. You guys know what November 5th is?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
November 5th is Guy Fawkes Day.
What a guy.
And a little bird told me that there may be some organized anonymous protests on November 5th.
Ah.
So if anyone wants to learn more about these, you can look for your local anonymous website. There's also apparently a YouTube video, which we will provide the link for on our show notes.
Nod, nod, wink, wink.
Right. But just to be clear, all of us individually in the Skeptics Guide, we do not endorse any kind of violence, and we only support completely non-violent forms of protest. Just to be clear, in case there was any doubt.
And from my knowledge, Anonymous never engages in violent protests.
Oh, there's one exception. If you find Sylvia Brown in the dark, you can punch her.
But only if you're an astronaut and you've been to the moon.
Buzz.
One more bit of news. This one is about Suzanne Summers.
Come and knock on our door.
Whose latest book is making the rounds, called Knockout, Interviews with Doctors Who Are Curing Cancer and How to Prevent Getting It in the First Place.
Not Hold the Clock, though.
Right. I don't know if Hold the Clock is in the book, actually.
Yeah.
I do know that Nicholas Gonzalez is in the book. We reported on Nicholas Gonzalez's regimen recently, which was for pancreatic cancer, which was worse than...
No treatment at all.
Yeah, than no treatment at all. It was actually... So the comparison was between the Gonzalez treatment and standard chemotherapy. The standard chemotherapy survival, I think, averages about 17 months, and on the Gonzalez regimen, it was 4 months, which is... At best, it's equal to not being treated. It may, in fact, even be a little bit worse than not being treated at all. And it's a horrific regimen to go through, coffee enemas and 1,000 pills a day. It's ridiculous. So that's one of the maverick doctors that Suzanne Summers is now promoting in her book and making the rounds. Just pushing cancer quackery. She's using whatever fleeting, fading celebrity she has to kill people, basically. ORAC actually has a very interesting report about some of the content of the book that I want to discuss.
Oh, he had to read it, huh?
Yeah, we'll link to his blog entry, and he goes into it in a lot of detail. But the interesting thing is that in the book, she tells a story about her recent whole-body cancer scare. And here's this skinny. She was not feeling well, like really not feeling well, went to the hospital and had a CAT scan of her thorax, I suppose. And on it, apparently, was some lesion. And it looked suspicious for cancer. Now, what she says is like the doctor sort of uncaringly swaggered into the room and said, "You got cancer all over your body," right? That's kind of her report of how things went down. It seems very implausible. Even if it is literally true, what that means is that she had a jerk doctor, right? That's like the worst case scenario. However, I never believe patient reports of how other doctors behaved and what they said. It's just never accurate. There's just only degrees of inaccuracy, really. People are not accurate historians, and any kind of emotional encounter, there's going to be information lost. Plus, it's also challenging and difficult to convey often complex medical information accurately. Often we make some assumptions about how we're saying things. Like, in fact, in his blog post, Orac gives the example, who is a cancer surgeon, where he told the patient, "You don't need chemotherapy." The patient interpreted that as meaning your case is hopeless, you're going to die, so there's no point in using chemotherapy. Which, of course, is exactly the opposite of what he meant, was that you're not bad enough to warrant needing chemotherapy. So it was an anecdotal example of just how easy it is to innocently be really significantly misunderstood by your patient.
Real quick, is it unethical to do an audio recording of patient-doctor conversations? Wouldn't that be a good thing to do? So you could actually go back in less emotional state or something and really hear how it went down, to have that on record.
It's not practical, I would imagine, for HIPAA, which is the, in this country, it's the rules regarding patient confidentiality.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose the patients can do that for their own purposes. If a patient asked me, "Hey, can I record this conversation?" I think once or twice a patient has actually done that to me. It's fine. If they want to record it for their own reference later, that's fine. We always highly recommend that family members are present, the more the better, and there are actually studies which show that the more people who are present in the room, the more information collectively they will retain. The patient by themselves, once you start throwing around the C word, then everything you say after that's just wah, 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 wah. They're just not processing information. You can't count on them really understanding anything from that point forward. They're just in a fog from what you just told them. So in any case, innocent miscommunications occur. I suspect a more plausible scenario in the case of Suzanne Summers, getting back to her, is that they said that you have suspicious lesions on this CAT scan and we have to do further evaluation. They might have mentioned that one of the possibilities is that this could be cancer or that it's suspicious for it and we have to do further workup. She is now telling the story that they told her she had cancer, which, again, just, we are... As a profession, I could tell you the standard is you never throw around the C word until you've proven that that's the case, right?
Mm-hmm.
She also was claiming that they were pushing chemotherapy on her. That's even more implausible because no oncologist would recommend chemotherapy unless you had a tissue diagnosis. That's just incredibly implausible. Now we're not talking about a physician who's a jerk, but physicians who are grossly incompetent. If you take her story at face value, but again, it just doesn't smell like a plausible scenario. She is, again, now retelling the story as an angry, very deluded and misinformed patient, right? The story gets a little bit better, though. So eventually they do further workup, and because the lesions were very disseminated, they were in various parts of her body, and they were suspicious, they did do a biopsy, and the biopsy turned out to show that she had a fungal infection, a specific fungal infection called coccidioidomycosis. This is one of the things that we always think about, but it's I would say uncommon, not necessarily rare. We see it, these kind of fungal infections. This particular fungal infection, though, is usually a mild infection, not a disseminated severe infection like what she had. Usually you'll only see a severe or disseminated fungal infection like this in somebody who is sick from some chronic illness or who is immunosuppressed. So Then she tells the story that, again, trying to make the doctor seem like a jerk, that he comes in and says, why didn't you tell me you were taking steroids? And her response to that basically was that this doctor didn't know what he was talking about, didn't know about bioidentical hormone therapy, which is her thing, right, the whole bioidentical hormones. So guess what? Suzanne Summers was giving herself steroid hormones, corticosteroids, had no concept of what these things were, thought that because they were quote-unquote bioidentical, which is nonsense, that they were therefore magically safe. She was essentially suppressing her own immune system with corticosteroids. And as a result of that, she got a disseminated fungal infection.
And, oh, my God.
And you can't quite blame the physicians for missing it initially, because it is not the kind of thing you would think about in somebody who is healthy and not immunocompromised.
And she didn't tell the doctor.
I think they discovered it when they were working her up. You know, she never really revealed it.
So she basically puts the veneer on this story that the doctor lied to her, screwed up his diagnosis, mishandled her whole case.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is that she went to the doctor, which she probably was very ashamed to even go. I'm making that assumption, but just from everything I've read about her, you know, she's not the kind of person that believes in medicine. She goes to the doctor. He saves her life.
Yeah,
the doctor saved her life.
Right, and she's trashing him for it because she almost killed herself by taking corticosteroids when she's not supposed to. Right. Unbelievable.
It is unbelievable.
I believe it.
I feel sorry for her physicians having to deal with that. I mean, still, she's a patient. You got to do what you got to do, right? I mean, you treat patients despite themselves. But it's the arrogance of ignorance, right? It's she doesn't know what she's talking about, but she's arrogant enough to think that she knows better than the medical community. You know, not just an individual doctor who may be a quack or substandard, but basically doctors in general. That's the arrogant part. And, you know, she made herself very sick as a consequence and then blamed her doctors for it.
Steve, how did MSNBC handle the interview? Were they being skeptical in any way, or were they just because she's famous?
It was softball.
They softballed. Okay, so my point being that you get a total jackass like Suzanne Summers not only gets on the news, but gets to spread her pseudoscience.
Yeah.
And her totally contrived story, you know?
Right.
What's wrong
but
here?
She used to be pretty once, I understand.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an abusive celebrity, in my opinion. But the other thing is people shouldn't listen to her. You know, don't listen to some has-been actress with half-baked, you know, pseudoscientific ideas.
You know, give me a pimple-faced geek doctor with a weird voice over a good-looking person that doesn't know shit.
Right. Let's go on to a couple of questions and emails. The first one comes from Adam Warren in Bristol, UK, and Adam writes, the universe is about 14 billion years old, so how come the observable universe is larger than 28 billion light years? As a follow-up, how is it possible for any star or galaxy or whatever to be more than 14 billion light years apart? Thanks for putting together such a great show.
Yeah, that's a it's a deceptive question, because it's when you start researching this, you're like, wow, this is more complicated than I thought. But the bottom line, you could bottom line it pretty easily. The bottom line is that the observable universe is bigger in light years than its age in years because of the expansion of the universe. That's right. The reason right there. If this was a flat universe and there was no expansion like it's expanding, then you would be right.
Yeah, matter itself cannot move through space at greater than the speed of light, but space can expand at greater than the speed of light. That there's no limitation on that.
That's what the crux of the issue right there is. And the other thing that you really gotta understand, and I'm still kind of grappling with it, is that defining distance in an expanding universe is very difficult. You just can't say how far away something is. That's an incredibly ambiguous question, but it's easy not to realize that. For example, if you want to know where things were when they emitted the light waves, that you get one answer. That's called the angular diameter distance. But if you want to know where everything is now, that's another answer, and that's called the co-moving radial distance. And the last one, if you want to know how long ago the light was emitted by an object, that's yet another answer, and that's called the light travel or look-back time. So it's more complicated than you think.
Imagine two objects in the universe, and then one emits light towards the other, and then, it is expanding away from the other object that will eventually receive the light, and the space that the light is traveling through is also expanding.
Right, it's getting redder and redder.
So you have to count all of those factors in before you decide how far away the thing is. And as you say, that has different specific operational meanings. But no matter how far the source is away at any of these times, one thing is true, that the light is as old as it has traveled through space, right? So if it has traveled for 14 billion light years, that light is 14 billion years old, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah, I don't think
it was emitted 14 billion years ago. So you could think about it from one respect, we can only look back 14 billion years because that's how old the universe is. There just hasn't been time for light to reach us from anything that's been emitted longer ago or farther away than that. But
that's a good point.
I mean, there is no longer ago than that. So that's as far away as we could see, you know, is 14 billion light years because of the time factor. But as you say, that galaxy that we're looking at that's 14 billion, that the light took 14 billion years to get to us, where is that galaxy now, right?
Right, and it's well beyond what you would think.
That question, and that gets to the question of how big is the observable universe right now?
I think presently that the accepted figure is about 48 billion light years is the size of the observable universe. But then you got to distinguish what's the difference between observable universe and visible universe. And, oh, man, it just gets all kind of wacky. But observable universe is basically, in theory, how far away something can be. And have you still see it? Even if the light didn't get here yet, could you see it if it was that far away? And that would be the observable universe. Farther away than that, then I believe that if it's any further away than that, then the space is expanding so fast, faster than the speed of light, essentially, that the light would just never get here, and you can't even in theory ever see that light. It will never get here.
But Bob, I found some sites, and tell me if you did too, that still were quoting the 28 billion light years across figure, just essentially doubling the age of the universe. So that's definitely wrong, right, for the reason that we just described. But again, you still see, you run across that figure in sites that are like reference sites, you know, talking about astronomy, you know?
Yeah, I think a lot of this information is changing fast.
So basically, you know, Bob and I, as you know, reasonably scientifically literate amateurs, are trying to figure out what the right answer is, and it's hard because it doesn't seem there's a lot of different conflicting pieces of information. It sounds like it's a moving target.
Well, let's ask that Dr. Werner.
Yeah, she might know. Yeah.
She might. She was throwing around names and terms, and she must know what she's talking.
Well, actually, we noticed that Dr. Pamela Gay was online, and so we decided to Skype her into the conversation, and she was good enough to oblige us with a little bit of last-minute astronomy consultation. Pamela Gay is the host of the popular astronomy podcast, Astronomy Cast. She is also the author of the Star Strider Astronomy blog and is involved with the 365 Days of Astronomy daily podcast honoring the Year of Astronomy, 2009. So we Skyped in Pamela, and this is what she had to say.
Pamela, we need your help.
Okay.
We don't know what the hell we're talking about.
I know a little bit.
That's all right. I had to ask for time to reconstruct my brain so I could talk about it. It's a hard topic.
Yeah, we had a question about the size of the universe, and we were chatting about it. And
the observable universe.
Right.
The size of, right, because we don't know what the size of the whole universe is. We really can't know, I guess.
What have we had? We've had ranges from 40 billion light years to 128 to 156.
Well, we know 28 is wrong, right? We know it's bigger than 28. That assuming that it's just the size of how far away the light had to travel to get to us is an underestimate.
So the edge of the stuff that we are currently able to see, which was a whole lot closer when it gave off its light, is now about 47 billion years away. Billion light years away.
Mm-hmm. So is that a radius?
Yes.
Okay, so that's different than what you said, Bob. You right, or is that what you were?
Maybe I misread it. I thought the 46 billion light year number was a diameter. You're right.
Okay.
The edge of the observable universe is now located about 46.5 billion light years away.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's about 92 billion light years in diameter.
Yeah, and it's actually, it's much better to say a little over 45, a little over 90, because we're still working to get a real understanding of how the acceleration of the universe is changing with time.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of this is going to get answered with the Herschel mission.
But not too long ago, they were quoting a figure of 156 billion light years diameter, and as if that were pretty solid.
We thought the universe was a lot older.
Mm-hmm.
So back in 2002, we completely revised the size of the universe using data from the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe. There was this problem in all the way up until the mid-90s, late 90s, where when we tried to estimate the age of the universe by finding the oldest stars and assuming, as one should, that the universe is older than the stars it contains, we got a fairly large number. We thought that the globular clusters were as much as maybe even 17 billion years old.
Mm-hmm.
And we looked around and we went, okay, how fast is the universe expanding? And we got a value somewhere, depending on who you talk to, between 60 and 90. And ran the numbers backwards, and we ended up with all sorts of different sizes for the universe. And it was only with the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, which looked at the cosmic microwave background and went, aha, I know how big the universe is, combined with looking at the expansion of the universe with Type 1a supernova. There was a pair of teams in 1998 that were able to measure the acceleration of the universe, the change of rate of expansion of the universe, and figure out that the universe was expanding slower in the past than it is right now.
Mm-hmm.
And by combining these two different results, we get two different regions of the variables that determine how the universe changes over time that cross. And the truth lies at the X mark in the case. The truth lies at the center of two overlapping error ellipses, for those of you who are statistical in the audience. And based on this and other techniques, we now know the universe is 13.7 plus or minus 0.2 billion years old. We know the evolution of the expansion rate over time for at least the nearby universe. And we're able to work backwards and figure out that the diameter of the part of the universe that we can see is over 90 billion light years.
Is that a constant rate of acceleration, the faster expanding universe as time goes on?
So the rate of expansion itself is increasing over time. And what we don't know is it a constant acceleration? Like if you drop a rock off a cliff, it will end up going about 10 meters per second further with each second. So roughly after the first second, it's going 10 meters a second. Roughly after the second second, it's going 20 meters per second. That's constant acceleration. There are hints that maybe the rate of expansion is not only accelerating, but that acceleration itself is also changing. But we're still working to get better at understanding that. And we need to get better at seeing far into the edges of the parts of the universe we can see and measuring very precisely supernova and how fast things are receding from us in the distant past.
Is there any way at all at this point in time to infer how big the total universe is, even beyond the visible universe?
Well, this is where it starts to get very tricky, because our best guess is that we probably only see a few percent of the visible universe. And that
of the total universe, you mean?
Of the total universe. So we see about 4% of the stuff in the visible universe.
Mm-hmm.
And then that visible universe itself, depending on who you read, is only a few percent of the entirety of the universe. And the way we get at that is as we look around, we look for places where, if you assume that we essentially are in a four-dimensional sphere, that means that if I took off in any one direction and went far enough, I'd come back to myself. Here on the Earth, I can go over the poles and get back to Illinois. I can go around through China and get back to Illinois. There's lots of different ways I can put a circle around the sphere we live on and come back to where I started. well, it's possible to come up with a similar type of shape in four-dimensional space, except you can't visualize it because we're humans.
Right.
Now, as we look around, we look for places where we see light taking two paths through the universe from the same object, and we don't see those reflections.
Mm-hmm.
And that puts limits on how big the universe can be. And so we're thinking, if the universe is finite, and we don't even know if the universe is finite in size, we only know it's finite in age. But if the universe is finite in size, we only see a small part of it. And the new Herschel mission is going to help us understand even better just what part of the universe is it that we're able to see. Not Herschel, sorry, the new Planck mission is going to help us be able to better understand what part of the universe we're able to see.
Cool. So we might have a figure at some point, not just it's a lot bigger than what we could see. some order of magnitude size of the total universe.
We will only be able to put better and better lower limits on it unless we hit the exact size.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is there's a certain observable limit, and once we hit that limit, we're stuck if the universe is bigger than the limit that the combination of technology and the fact that every second as the universe expands, there's stuff falling off the edge of visible space that we're never going to be able to see.
Mm.
And we can't recover that information. Once it's gone over the edge, it's gone.
It's going to be very lonely in the deep future when it gets real bad.
Yeah,
and dark and
be
cold.
Us. Yeah, dark, cold, and...
And lonely.
Just the local group, supermassive... galaxy that whatever
it will be,
when we merge with Andromeda and the other galaxies in the local group, that's it.
Right. How well, sad. Our local group at least has the dignity to fall into the local supercluster. So we'll have a few more friends.
Oh, okay. I feel better.
But the stars are all going to be winking out, so the entire universe is going to be illuminated at least for a few trillion years by nothing more than the smallest little red dwarf stars giving off their faint, faint red glow.
Right. Well, we'll just jump to another universe at that point, a younger one.
That'd be better. Parallel universe.
Just click your heels together.
Oh, if only it were that easy, it would make so many quantum mechanic and cosmology questions so much easier.
Right.
Well, Pamela, thank you so much for straightening that out for us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and thanks for tolerating the fact that my brain's a little bit fuzzy tonight.
No, it was great.
Doesn't seem it.
Definitely have to keep you on speed dial.
Anytime.
All right, good night. Let's do another question, then we'll go back to her. Question number two comes from Anders Starmark in, I know I'm going to pronounce this wrong, Gothenburg, Sweden. What do you think, Jay? You've been to Sweden.
It's definitely Göteborg, ends with Borg.
Göteborg,
it's G A with two dots over it. T E.
That's an umlaut. That's a long A. It's like gay.
Göteborg.
Göteborg. Göteborg.
It looks like a tilde to me.
It didn't translate in my.
Oh, okay.
In Word or whatever.
It has Borg in it.
I had a girl that works with me that is Swedish explain to me how to pronounce that, and I totally forgot.
So you're useless, is what you're telling me.
Yeah, I'm useless.
I'm using the German way of going about it. So I imagine it's similar.
Okay, so in Borg, Sweden.
And, what are you saying?
And Anders writes, if you were mad scientists, how would you use your knowledge to take over the world?
I have an answer.
All right, Jay.
Okay, first of all, if I was a mad scientist, meaning crazy / hell-bent type of deal...
Megalomaniacal.
I would definitely create a zombie virus.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
Yeah, I mean, think about it, Bob, right?
Ooh, I like it.
It would propagate itself. I mean, you have to start with a few zombies here or there. You seed them. There's no way humanity would win.
Would you have to zombify yourself?
But then you would be in charge of a world of zombies.
But the point is to take over the world. You're crazy.
Yeah, but then, you know, what about the women and the money? And the power. What's the point of taking over the world if it's filled with zombies?
first you get the women.
There could be some cute zombies out there.
Then you get the power. Then you get the women. So, yeah, I guess you're right, Steve. But, you know, that's my version of a mad scientist. I mean, that would work.
I could probably do it.
And I'll tell you, it would probably take 2 weeks for me to take over the world with a good zombie virus.
Mm-hmm.
2 weeks.
I could do it in 2 days.
Go ahead, Bob.
2 words, nano goo. I would send out nanites into the atmosphere to reproduce using the carbon that's there, and each one would home in on a person, set up house, reproduce some more, tweak hormones, neurotransmitters, dopamine levels, etc., until each person on the planet was extremely motivated to do whatever the hell I wanted.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
That's it.
All right, what about you, Ev?
Mad Science, I was thinking I would invent... Well, did anyone see the movie Nine? Mm-hmm.
Nine!
So you had the scientist who invented the robot, the war for peaceful purposes, for peacekeeping purposes. And you make this, and you make one robot that builds other robots and more robots and so forth. And you just control this massive, massive army of robots, and you go about it enslaving humanity through your power over.
Okay,
robots.
So basically through military prowess.
Let them do all the work.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So Jay's the zombie apocalypse. Bob is the nanite apocalypse, and Evan is the robot apocalypse. Got it.
Affirmative.
Now, what I would do.
What do you got?
First thing I would do is start a popular science podcast.
Yeah.
And then once it gets to about 50,000-60,000 regular listeners, I would seed doing the post-production for the podcast, I would seed it with subliminal backward masking messages that would alter the vibrational state of people's brains.
Yeah, why not use binary,
binaural beats? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I'm not going to give away too many details now.
All right, go ahead.
That would make you less mad.
And then I would slowly and mentally enslave the listeners of that podcast until they were my utter thralls, and then I would spread out from there. They would then infiltrate further podcasts and other social media until slowly the entire world was enslaved.
I don't know, Steve. I think your idea sucks.
No, I like it, but you're just going to have to cut this out of the episode.
No, that's not true, Bob, because nobody's going to believe me anyway.
But, Steve...
It's all plausible, Steve, except those first couple of
steps.
I don't think that'll ever happen. Yeah,
your premise is totally out of whack. Nano goo all the way.
I still think that if all of our efforts began today, that mine would win out over the rest of yours.
Think so?
Yes. Zombies?
What, are you going to turn this into a contest?
But the zombies don't go after robots, right? I mean, they ignore inanimate things. Right?
Yeah, I think Evan's robots would destroy your zombies, Jay.
The hell they would.
Crush them underfoot.
Yeah, but I have more. I'll have more. I can make a 100,000.
No, my robots make other robots. They continually recreate themselves. Replicate themselves.
But Bob and Jay have 7 billion prefabricated vessels already, though, Evan, right?
Yeah, you'd have to stop me in my initial stages in order to screw with my plans for domination.
My nanites can all link together in the atmosphere, preventing solar radiation from hitting the Earth and preventing your robots from being powered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then they would just charge themselves off of people, though, Bob.
Oh, damn. They would never do that.
But Steve, clearly, my zombie horde would completely overrun your insane followers.
I think you're underestimating the ingenuity and the power of 60,000 skeptics. I think they would defeat your zombies.
Well, there's only one way to find out.
Find a way. Okay, you've forced my hand. The thing about my robot army is that they have flux capacitors and they can travel through time and destroy you all before you get to do
you
all
got
of
me.
Your things.
Time so, travel trumps all.
Yeah,
that's why it's a lame
does.
Plot device. Yeah. All right, so does that answer your question, Anders? And is it just a coincidence that he's from a city that has the name Borg in it? I don't know
about that.
Irrelevant. Right,
one more question. This one comes from Keith Simmons, and Keith writes, "A big hello to SGU from Darwin, Australia. I am writing in to seek your opinion on something I came across on a Paranormal and Believers podcast. It may be a good topic for discussion on the show. As painful as it is to listen to them, in the interest of being a good skeptic, I find it compulsory to get both sides of the story. They mentioned a possible development in man's quest to cheat death itself. They reported that there could be a way to shut down your body and organs and reanimate them without any ill effects. Of all things, by using poison gas. A biologist named Mark Roth is reported to have been been experimenting with a gas, hydrogen sulfide, that when inhaled replaces the oxygen in the body and thus stops the chemical reactions in the body cells that initiate degeneration. By doing this, even though all vital signs have ceased, the body will not die and remains in a state of suspended animation. Roth reportedly started experimenting on fish embryos by draining the oxygen from the embryo, finding that the embryo stopped growing, and when he reintroduced the oxygen, they started growing again. He claims to have repeated the experiment on fruit flies and now rats, and the process works. However, he reached a hurdle. He says he needs to introduce a hydrogen sulfide by injection to anything larger than a rat. I would love to know what you guys think. Keep up the great work. Hope you make it to Australia soon. P.S. I smell a zombie plague on the horizon.
All right, so I hate to break the news to you guys.
I don't smell anything.
But I'm the biologist, Mark Roth, and this is exactly indeed how I create my zombie horde.
That's it.
Yep.
Mark Roth is your mad scientist pseudonym.
Yep. Steve, the real question is, will it stop the decaying of your tissue?
I could see how it would slow down aerobic bacteria, not anaerobic bacteria, but without your cells can't make energy. They'll lice. They will destroy themselves.
Yeah, but Steve, I did some research on this, and the idea here is that when oxygen levels drop, say from the normal 21% to 5%, people die, rats die, fish die, everybody dies. But the reason you die is because the lack of oxygen, or the decreased amount of oxygen, starts a cascade of chemical reactions, and that's what's really causing us to die. But when you drop oxygen levels below, say a tenth of a percent, then something different happens. Then that cascade does not start, because you need a certain amount of oxygen for this chain reaction of chemical reactions to start. When you don't have enough oxygen for that cascade to start, then apoptosis, or cell death, does not happen, or at least it would take a while for it to happen. So I think this guy has pretty much shown that is the case for things like fish and rats, that is the case, and that this type of suspended animation has been done for those types of animals. But now the problem, though, is that when he scaled this up to people, or I guess big mammals like pigs, it didn't work. He wasn't able to get them into anything close to suspended animation. Or I think the main goal here is not really suspended animation, but actually a decrease in respiration, so that you only require 10% of the breathing or respiration that you normally would. And the application, considering DARPA's involved in this, the application, of course, is for wounded soldiers. You get a catastrophic injury on the battlefield, you bleed out or whatever before anybody can get to you. If you could just administer something that could make them breathe where respiration and metabolism slows down greatly, then the chance of surviving goes way, way up. So the problem now then is that with pigs and stuff, is that he can't get them anywhere near that state. So he's trying different methods, like using sodium sulfide and injecting that into the bloodstream, and that turns into hydrogen sulfide. And so they're actually working on it now in Canada and Australia. They're doing some tests on people to see if what kind of doses would be tolerated and things. I mean, they did a test with the sodium sulfide injection in mice, and they were able to reduce heart damage from heart attacks by 72%. I mean, it's showing some amazing stuff, at least in rats and stuff.
Well, I think clearly a lot more research needs to be done on this. I mean, it's interesting, and I'm looking forward to hearing more results from the research.
Slowing it down is one thing. If you could slow down metabolism, that's fine. I'm very skeptical that he could stop metabolism dead indefinitely without there being any untoward events. I mean, I know he's claiming, I'm seeing in this one article that he was able to do it with a rat for an hour and then bring it back just by turning off the gas. Has that been replicated by anybody?
No, I've read some other doctors are using his ideas. As like I said, in Australia and Canada, they're doing tests now with the sodium sulfide.
All right. Well, it sounds like something that we should look into a little bit more. Again, the notion of slowing down metabolism in order to preserve damage, that's established, and that's not an extraordinary claim.
Right.
Stopping it completely, I don't know. We'd have to see. I mean, again, if you're doing it for a couple of hours, that's the kind of thing that's that will have medical applications, right?
Oh, yeah. Huge.
So, and that's plausible. Doing it for longer periods of time, like days or months.
Or years.
That's different. Or, in, you know, quote-unquote indefinitely. I mean, this evidence is
right.
A long way from going towards that. This sounds like they did it for an hour.
Steve, you got to crawl before you run, you know?
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items, four facts, two real and one fake. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to sniff out the fake. Is everyone ready for this week?
Challenge Absolutely. Accepted.
All right, here we go. Item number one, new research finds that bad driving is partly genetic. Item number two, researchers find that ADHD is associated with consuming even a small amount of alcohol while pregnant. Item number three, a recent analysis shows that 60% of household dust comes from outside air and tracked in dirt.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Bob, go first.
Okay. The genetic driving. Yeah, that kind of makes sense to me. Some people just, I just can't see them ever being a good driver. Some people might say that about me, but that's beside the point. Let's see, going to the third one here. So most of dust comes from outside. That's tracked in. Yeah, that kind of makes sense to me as well. I mean, the common wisdom is that dust is mostly shed skin cells and stuff, but with other stuff thrown in there. But it makes sense to me that a lot of it would be just stuff that's tracked in over time on clothing and feet, of course, which then eventually floats around and lands on stuff. Now, the ADHD, so even a small amount of alcohol when you're pregnant can raise your risk of ADHD. That doesn't seem quite right to me. I'm going to say that one is fiction.
Okay, Jay?
Okay, so on the one about bad driving being genetic, I think that's definitely plausible. I mean, if you could think about how much of our behavior is actually genetic, why wouldn't certain skills be genetic? Of course they are. So I think that's plausible, and I believe that. The second one about drinking alcohol and that increasing ADHD. What could the alcohol actually be doing to damage the brain of the fetus? Now, Steve, I wasn't even sure that the alcohol passed into the fetus's blood. I guess it does. How, Steve, can you tell me how filtered is the blood that from a mother to a fetus?
Through the placenta, you mean?
Yeah.
Significantly.
Okay. It's possible that it's filtered, but... And then if it wasn't, let's say the alcohol hit the developing brain of a fetus. I mean, okay. It's I don't know. Something about that just doesn't seem right, but I don't know enough. The last one, a recent analysis shows. I was under the impression that most of the dust in our homes came from the inhabitants in the homes, from dead skin cells. This is saying that dust comes in from the outside air and tracked in dirt. Well, of course we track in dirt and lots of other nasty stuff. I mean, just think about this. You're wearing shoes that you wear in a public restroom, and then you walk in the carpet inside your house. Okay, got that? That's gross. I don't know. I think that one's the fake.
Okay, Evan?
Sorry, Jay. Which one did you think was the fake?
The one about the household dust.
All right. Bad driving being partly genetic. Sure. Why not? So many things are due to partial genetics or entirely genetic. And then the ADHD. And a small amount of alcohol while pregnant. Not sure. And then the household dust. 60% of it comes from outside air and tracked in dirt. Yeah. I'm surprised it's not actually more than that. That sounds right. So I'll say the ADHD one is fiction.
Okay, so you all agree that new research finds that bad drinking is partly genetic. And that one is completely science. This is a study from the UC Irvine, and they found a specific gene, a particular gene variant, that in subjects who had this variant, they performed 20% worse on driving tests than people without this variant. And on follow-up tests a few days later, they yielded similar results. They also say about 30% of Americans have this bad driving gene variant. Researchers said that these people make more errors from the get-go, and they forget more of what they learned after time. So again, not surprising. Genes have a lot to say about how our brains are wired up, which has a lot to say about our behavior. So it's all very plausible. But it's interesting, 30% of people out on the road there are genetically bad drivers.
Sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They're all in Boston, too.
They have to come from somewhere, you know?
Now, this is a study with 29 people, so it's smallish. You know, it definitely needs to be replicated.
Well, that's really small. I don't really like that.
Yeah.
So let's go on to number two. Researchers find that ADHD is associated with consuming even small amount of alcohol while pregnant, and that one is the fiction.
Yes.
Ah.
That one is fiction.
I knew it.
Because, I mean, that's totally plausible. But Jay, alcohol does pass the placenta. There is something called the fetal alcohol syndrome. Fetal alcohol syndrome, which is associated with mental retardation. But what research has found is that there's actually two studies here. There's one a few weeks back, which found that alcohol is not associated with ADHD, the opposite of what I said. But the first research that caught my eye was a study that showed that low levels of folate during pregnancy are associated with ADHD. So folate has been implicated in other neurological developmental disorders as well, such as neural tube defects, spina bifida, for example. So it's already the recommendation that women who are of childbearing age and who are at risk for becoming pregnant, again, you can't start this when you find out you're pregnant because then it's too late. Most of the really important stuff has already happened by the time you realize you're pregnant. You have to be on prenatal vitamins, on folate, prior to becoming pregnant, essentially. So you should take it while you're trying to get pregnant. So this adds to the evidence that folate is important for early nervous system development. There's also evidence that children born to mothers who are low in folate have small head circumference.
Wow.
So this actually is affecting, you know, overall brain growth. So bottom line, there's now multiple lines of evidence that show that women really should take folate during pregnancy.
Folic acid.
Yes. Which means that a recent analysis shows that 60% of household dust comes from outside air and tracked in dirt is science.
Yes, sir.
And yeah, this caught my eye, Jay, because I too had heard from many sources that the majority of dust in the home was dead skin cells. And that certainly does make up a portion of it.
Yeah.
But it turns out that an analysis of household dust shows that 60% of it is actually from outdoors.
So here's a fine example of something that I believed in, that I had told people, that had been a part of my information. It was wrong.
Yeah.
And I am
partially wrong.
Now you had
formally changing my belief right now.
Now you have to go, Jay, and tell every single person you ever told about the skin cells that's incorrect.
Well, how do you explain those dusty old haunted houses?
Yeah, right.
That comes from a lot of decay of the house itself.
Yeah, the wood, probably.
Well, so what they found is that it includes dead skin cells. It includes fibers from carpets and upholstered furniture. Mm-hmm. But again, 60% tracked in soil and airborne particles blown in from outdoors. This is of interest because that blown in dirt particles and tracked in dirt particles contain lead, arsenic, and other potentially harmful substances. Yeah, so
toxins.
They conjure up the image of a child, you know, dropping a toy in the dust on the floor and then putting it in their mouth and potentially getting exposed to lead and arsenic through that route. So it's important to track this down, you know.
That's an unsafe atmosphere.
The fact is, we live in a filthy world.
Yes.
Dirty, filthy, horrid world.
The natural world is filthy and horrible. That's why we developed a detoxification system and an immune system, right?
Yep.
So congratulations, Bob and Evan.
Well, thank you.
It's uncanny how many of these I've gotten wrong this year.
It is. It's actually starting to defy the odds.
Yeah.
Worse than random guessing, I would imagine.
Ooh.
Conversely, this is, I think, my best year by far.
Yeah, you've been doing really well, Bob. And I can always tell when you've read it. Your level of confidence is way up.
Yeah, this one, I pretty much read all three.
The second one, I
knew you twisted. What?
Stop it. Stop educating yourself. Educate yourself on Thursdays, not Wednesdays.
I do it every day.
I'm going to have to just start reading a lot more science news.
God forbid.
I mean, the thing is, I read a lot of science news to prepare for the show, you know, just keep myself up to date so we, you know our process. But, Steve, you pick these like 2 hours before we do the show.
Maybe. So, anyway, Evan, tell us about last week's Who's That Noisy?
All right. Well, let's play it again for those of you who missed it.
And Evan, what was that noisy?
That was our dear, dear friend, the species, now I'll try to pronounce this correctly, Crinia georgiana, also known as the quacking frog, or Schutes, T-S-C-H-U-D-I, apostrophe S, Schutes frog. This is a frog native to southwest Western Australia, apparently popular around Perth, from what I've read.
Now, I saw a lot of people guess types of frogs. Did anyone get it exactly?
No.
I didn't think so.
There were Cuban tree frogs. That seemed to be the most popular guess, and some other green frogs. But nope, nobody said Australian frog. Nobody came close, geographically or otherwise.
Nobody guessed Mongolian death frog?
Frogs, eh? Yeah.
Now, although it was interesting, the last person who guessed said, I must be way off base here. I was thinking it was a duck of some sort. And they were actually the first person to equate that quacking sounded kind of like a duck. So I'll give them a B-plus for
credit.
Effort. Yeah, B-plus for effort on that one. But no correct guesses this week. So
you stumped them all, Mr. Bernstein.
I am a mad scientist, after all.
What do you got for this week?
So for this week, we've got something that is less noisy and a little more audible. Okay, here we go. Have a listen.
How do you feel this morning?
I feel good so far.
So far. Can't be too careful.
All right, that's it. That's all you get.
Oh, good work, Evan.
Well, thank you, sir.
So, Jay, you got a quote for us this week?
I have a quote tonight from Marcus Aurelius. It was sent to me by Steve.
All right, but I pilfered this from someone.
Was it someone that sent it in?
No, actually, I took this from the signature of an email from Dr. Joseph Albeats, who's writes for us on science-based medicine, and we're in an email group together. And I noticed that in his signature. I said, oh, that'd be a great quote for the show.
It is, indeed. So Marcus Aurelius was a Roman emperor from 161 to 180. And he was thought to be one of the five good emperors and was also an important Stoic philosopher. And the quote is, "If anyone can show me and prove to me that I am wrong in thought or deed, I will gladly change. I seek the truth, which never yet hurt anybody. It is only persistence in self-delusion and ignorance which does harm." Marcus Aurelius Antonius Augustus!
That was great.
Good quote.
It is a good quote. It's a good quote, boys.
I wanted to attribute listener Zachary from Albany, New York, sent in last week's Who's That Noisy. So thank you for that, Zachary.
Thank you, Zach.
Hey, guys. We're coming up on a year away from our Australia trip, so any listeners out there that are interested in seeing us come, please feel free to donate to that trip on our website.
We have been getting some donations, and we appreciate it. Thank you to everyone out there who has donated, both to the SGU General Fund, just to keep the show going, and to the dedicated Australia Fund to bring us down to Australia and make sure that we have enough funds to stay there a long time and make some trips around. But we can always do more.
Absolutely. I mean, chartering a Concorde ain't free, folks.
if it were even still flying.
That's right.
From what I've learned from Richard Saunders and everything, it's quite an unbelievably long plane ride. And, we're going to be leaving from Connecticut, so it's even longer than where where typically Richard's going to Las Vegas. But, I think we're going to be in a plane just about 20 hours, and it's probably, you know, a good solid 24 hours door-to-door for us. So, whoa.
Yeah, it's going to be a harsh day. I also have a quick favor to ask our listeners. I am putting together a series of lectures on medical myths. I'll give you more information as this project moves forward about how to get it. Hopefully, it'll be available within a year or so. It's going to be a long process. But what I'm asking from you now is to email me any suggestions for topics that you would like to be covered in such a series. Are there any thing you think might be a medical myth or anything, any medical myths you would like to see discussed, please send it to me. Just use the usual contact form and put medical myths in the subject heading so I can keep track of those particular emails.
Steve, thanks for another week.
Thank all of you guys for joining me. Hopefully Rebecca will be with us next week. I understand she's just getting back into London. We'll try to square our schedules, and hopefully we'll get her back on the show next week. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.